It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at three pieces of drunk driving legislation before the State Assembly today.
First, the group StoryCorps has been collecting stories and encouraging us to record them too for 10 years now.
We've got StoryCorps founder Dave Isay with us. He just released a new book, Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Nice to talk to you.
So, Dave, you and StoryCorps have a long history with us here at WPR, and you join us the day after Thanksgiving most years on the Joy Cardine Show. If they haven't called you yet, they're gonna, by the way.
Okay.
But for people just meeting you now, what is StoryCorps?
Sure. Well, StoryCorps launched 10 years ago last week. A very simple idea. We started in Grand Central Terminal. We built a booth where you can bring anyone who you want to honor by listening to their story. It could be a parent, a grandparent, friend. You're met at the booth by a facilitator who works for StoryCorps, who brings you inside the booth, and then you sit across from, say, your grandmother for 40 minutes in this kind of sacred space. The lights are low, complete silence, almost like a recording booth. And the facilitator's in the corner, and it's kind of a method as best possible to distill your life in 40 minutes. Very intense conversation. At the end of the 40 minutes, two CDs have been burned. One goes home with you, the other stays with us and goes to the Library of Congress, so your great-great-great-great-grandkids can get to know your grandmother through her voice and story. And excerpts, of course, are played every Friday on NPR, on Morning Edition, on Wisconsin Public Radio. And we have books and animations and all kinds of other stuff. We recently did our 50,000th interview,
wow,
which makes it the largest collection of human voices ever gathered, with about 100,000 people, because most people come in pairs. But I think we're just getting started with StoryCorps. As you know, and listeners know from listening on Morning Edition, it's a project that's about a lot of things, mostly about listening, but about finding the poetry and grace and dignity and beauty in the stories all around us when we take the time to listen. And our goal is to help to make that part of the fabric of this country at some point. So we've got a long way to go.
And at that opening day you mentioned 10 years ago, I think I read that oral historian Studs Terkel was there. Can you talk about how he helped at least to influence this idea?
Well, Studs, who has since passed away, was a very close friend and a mentor and a hero to me. And he was this great oral historian and raconteur. He was nice enough. He must have been 91 or 92 at the time when we opened the booth, to come to Grand Central and cut the ribbon. And when he cut the ribbon, he said to us, we know who the architect of Grand Central Station was, but who is it who laid these floors, who built these walls? Those are the stories you must get through StoryCorps. And he kind of laid down the gauntlet. We've been fighting as best we can over the last 10 years to live up to that mandate and tell the stories of what Studs would call the et ceteras, all of us, the rest of us, regular people.
And a very important decision early on. The goal is not that you, Dave, or the other StoryCorps people interview those people. They kind of interview each other. Why is that important?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I think what StoryCorps is in the kind of the human connection and the wisdom business. I had, it's very early on from before StoryCorps started, we knew that this was going to be people talking to each other. And, I think it's an opportunity to sit with, and this gets to this book that just came out, which is about kind of honoring the people who are most important in your life. And I think what StoryCorps is an opportunity for us to take someone who really matters to us and bring them to this booth and have this conversation. You know, your cell phones are off, your computers are off, it's you and a loved one and a facilitator in this booth. And by asking them, who are you? How do you want to be remembered? What are the most important lessons you've learned in life? Telling that person how much you love them. You know, it's kind of, I've been thinking in the last couple of days, it's sort of the exact opposite of reality TV, because nobody comes to get rich, nobody comes to get famous. It's just it's an act of generosity. So that's been the idea from the beginning, and it's just worked in ways I never would have imagined. You know, when StoryCorps started, I envisioned it as a 10-year project, and so this would be, we'd be done now. But about a year into it, I saw, the potential power of this very, very simple idea, and retired from making public radio documentaries, which I'd been happily doing for decades, to devote the rest of my life to this thing. So here we are.
Well, I want to get a taste of how this works. We've got some excerpts, some recordings of the excerpts that are in your book, Ties That Bind. The first one we'll play is Susan McClinton talking with her husband, Philip McClinton. Let's give a listen.
I came into the topless bar that you were bouncing to compete in amateur night because there was a prize at the end. And at the time, I had two children to support, so I needed the money. I remember at one point you said, I'll keep an eye on you.
I thought, she doesn't belong in here. She didn't need to be in this place.
And I think that was the beginning of our relationship. You said, I'm going to take you rattlesnake hunting. I thought you were absolutely out of your mind. But I had so much fun, I thought, hey, this is something I might want to do on a regular basis. And I remember at one point telling you that I had always enjoyed science in school. And you said, well, why don't we go back to school? And I said, you're crazy.
Neither one of us had anything but a ninth grade education. I'd tried 10th grade three times, and I couldn't cut it. And we didn't think anyone would take us. And I said, call them and ask. And they accepted us on probation. We took all of our courses together.
You didn't know anything about school. And I recall several times when you told me you just didn't think you could make it anymore. And I would always tell you, I'll get you through it.
And we were both working on biology degrees.
Remember cell biology? I drew a diagram and taped it up in the bathroom on the mirror. So in the mornings, you'd have to look and learn it from there.
Without your help, I'd have never gotten through this because a lot of it I just plain didn't understand. But I think the thing I'm proudest of is that you finally did things that you never dreamed you could do, and you did them so well. You turned into a fine field biologist.
I guess I learned for the first time that I really was a person of worth. You know, after my life started out so bumpy, never thought we'd get a college degree. And if you hadn't come into my life, I think I would have ended up in a very bad place.
Yeah.
It was a rescue romance is what we called it because we saved each other.
Excerpt from Ties That Bind, a StoryCorps collection. Dave, is there something about being recorded and listened to and in, as you say, this quiet place without the phone on, does it change the way we think about our lives?
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, I listened to that clip, which is, I think, the first story in the book, where she says, you know, that that relationship with her husband helped her realize she was a person of worth, you know, which speaks to what happens in the booth. And I do think that this act of being listened to tells people that reminds people that their lives matter. And, you know, in many ways, you know, I think of, you know, in hospice, they have this saying that there, you know, there are five things that you want to say to someone before they die. And if I remember, it's I thank you, I love you, forgive me, I forgive you, and finally goodbye. And in many ways, you know, what happens in the StoryCorps booth is that you have the opportunity to say those things to someone while they're not in hospice, say it today and kind of have this sense of closure with someone and the sense that you're leaving something for history. So, I mean, every day of StoryCorps has been kind of a surprise and a miracle. And, you know, one of them is that when we are a public service. So when you come to StoryCorps, at the end of the interview, if you don't sign a release, it doesn't go into the Library of Congress. You've had a great experience. You take the CD away. You put it in a safety deposit box. We couldn't be happier. And because of the intimacy of what was happening in these interviews in the early days, I thought we'd have a compliance rate of maybe 80%. And 50,000 interviews later, it's 99.9%.
Wow.
So everybody, you know, really wants to leave this record for the future. And I've also been amazed that, you know, when StoryCorps started, I had these fears of kind of Jerry Springer moments and people, you know, revealing things and trying to kill each other. And, you know, every single one of these 50,000 interviews has been done with grace. You know, I think if it's changed me in any way these 10 years, it's made me much more hopeful about who we are as Americans, about the people around us. The facilitators will always say when they come off the road, and their job is basically collecting the wisdom of humanity, and we've had hundreds of them now traveling the country, recording these stories, being present for these stories. And they'll all say, you know, if you ask them, what did you learn? They'll say that people are basically good. And I think when we were at 1,000 interviews or 5,000 or 10,000, you could say that it was it was a tainted pool of people who come to StoryCorps, but at 50,000 in all 50 states, it's 1,700 cities and everybody across the political spectrum, every kind of person you can imagine, I think we're getting to the point where you can say there's some truth to that.
We're talking to Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps, author of Ties That Bind, a collection of stories from StoryCorps. We're going to listen to some more of those stories coming up.
We'll pick up that conversation in just a few moments. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
We continue our conversation now with Dave Isay from StoryCorps. He has a new book out. It's called Ties That Bind. Dave, I want to give a listen to another story from the book. This is Lynn Weaver talking to his daughter, Kimberly Weaver, about his father, Ted. Here it is.
My father was everything to me. And it's actually kind of difficult talking about him without becoming very emotional. Up until, you know, he died, every decision I made, I'd always call him. And he would never tell me what to do, but he would always listen and say, well, what do you want to do? And he made me feel that I could do anything that I wanted to do. I can remember when we integrated the schools that there were many times when I was just scared. And I didn't think that I would survive. And I'd look up and he'd be there. And whenever I saw him, I knew that I was safe. You know, I always tell you that your mama is the smartest person I've ever met. But I think my father ranks right up there as brilliant. When I was in high school, I was taking algebra and I was sitting at the kitchen table trying to do my homework. And I got frustrated and said, I just can't figure this out. So my father said, what's the problem? He came by. He said, what's the problem? And I said, that's just algebra. And he said, well, let me look at it. I said, Dad, they didn't even have algebra in your day. And I went to sleep. And around 4 o'clock that morning, he woke me up. He said, come on, son, get up. He set me at the kitchen table and he taught me algebra. What he had done is sit up all night and read the algebra book. And then he explained the problems to me so I could do them and understand them. And to this day, I live my life trying to be half the man my father was, just half the man. And I would be a success if my children loved me half as much as I love my father.
A StoryCorps excerpt there. Dave, Lynn mentioned that he had a hard time talking about his dad without getting emotional. It's hard sometimes to listen to the stories without getting emotional. You really just get amazing emotional stories from the people who participate.
Yeah, well, it's not, you know, this is what happens in the booth. You know, I think of that story, and thank you for playing it. It's one that means a lot to me. I had the pleasure of meeting Lynn Weaver. His story was recorded as part of the GRIO initiative. We've had 9 huge national special initiatives. GRIO is our African-American initiative. GRIO is the West African word for storyteller. And I went down to the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta the month after we opened it to listen to stories back with families who'd recorded them, and Lynn was there. We played that story, and I got this email the day after that event where he writes, Mr. Isay, you'll never know how honored and touched I was by the playing of the remembrance of my dad. After I got home, I realized that the evening of the StoryCorps GRIO reception was the anniversary of my father's death.
Wow.
Even in death, he continues to embrace me with his love. Signed, Lynn Weaver, chairman of surgery, Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta. So, you know, Ted Weaver, who, as you said, was a janitor in Knoxville, Tennessee, who is the most important person in Lynn's life, who walks this walk and lives this life of, you know, decency, brilliance, and honesty. You know, I think that when you hear a story like that, we're kind of walking on sacred ground. And I think that's why people get emotional when they listen to these stories, even when they're, you know, funny. Yeah. And to me, you know, Ted Weaver stands for so much of what StoryCorps is about, you know, that, you know, he's the kind of person we should be holding up to our kids as examples of who they can and should grow up to become and building statues to and so forth. There is no greater American hero. And, you know, and these stories are just hidden in plain sight all around us.
It's great that these are getting into the Library of Congress, because I can just imagine the social historians of the future using this as just this amazing treasure trove of stories and evidence and a taste of what life is like for us now and in the lives of the people that are talking there.
Absolutely. And I think even more so, I mean, the nature of what happens in these interviews is that it's a passing of wisdom. So in a way, what we're doing is kind of collecting the wisdom of humanity. I think it's going to be very valuable. But even just the, you know, we hold half of our slots for people who might not have heard of us through public radio. We do hundreds of partnerships with nonprofits each year. So it could be people involved in the juvenile justice system or homeless folks who come to the booth in Paris to record their interviews. And I think that people who may feel like their voices aren't heard or their lives may not matter, knowing that they're, that indeed that's not true, and that their lives do matter, and that their story is important enough to be part of American history at the Library of Congress, can be very meaningful to people.
I want to listen to at least one more before we're done. This is Jenna Alperin. I think she's 12, and she's talking with her grandmother, MJ Seide.
Seide.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Here it is.
How has your life been different than what you thought it was going to be?
I thought that my life was probably not one that was going to be worth living. There was this hole that I had all of my life because I never thought I'd be able to walk along the beach and hold somebody's hand because I'm gay. But, you know, when I fell in love with my mommy, I knew that she was my soulmate. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
I had never felt that way about anyone before. And after she had gotten her divorce from Grandpa Jim, she was very upfront with your mom. She told your mom she was in love, and it was with a woman. And that was the first time that anyone was proud to say that they loved me. That made me the happiest I'd ever been in my life. And then when I got to know your mom and Uncle Justin, I knew that I had hit paradise because I now have a family that I can wrap my arms around.
Is there anything that you've never told me but you want to tell me now?
You know, you and I talk about most things, but this is the first time that we've ever talked about the fact that I'm gay. And I guess what I want to ask you is, does it embarrass you to have a gay grandma?
No. It doesn't really matter because it just matters my relationship with you.
I always tell you how much I love you, but I don't know that you can really understand the depth of it because you're someone that I never thought would be in my life, and I can't imagine my life without you. You have always been a child that makes up her own mind, and I am so, so proud of you.
Well, you're one of my favorite grandmas. You do, like, a lot of things with me, like ride roller coasters and play poker. I don't know what life would be like without you here.
I love you, sweetheart.
Love you, too.
Wow. Well, I'd read that one. I hadn't listened. Much, definitely more powerful listening. So that's the thing, man. You're not just getting stories. You're getting moments by bringing people together like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see there and in so many of these stories that the microphone gives you the license. You know, as she said, we never talked about the fact that I'm gay, you know, and it gives them the license to have this conversation that they don't normally get to have. You know, I think of this quote from Mother Teresa, who used to say, "We've forgotten that we belong to each other." And this book, the Ties That Bind book, I hope does a little bit to help us remember.
So even if people don't do it with StoryCorps, and I know we've talked about this on the National Day of Listening shows, make the case for getting people, sitting them down and having these conversations and recording them.
Well, that's the easiest case in the whole world to make. You know, I did an interview, and I write about this in the book. I did an interview about 8 years ago with my dad, who obviously was a very important person in my life. And about a year ago, he was diagnosed with, he was working, and the next day he was diagnosed with cancer, and he was dead 9 days later. And, you know, it wasn't until 3 a.m. on the night that he died, listening to this interview for the first time, I'd never listened to it before, that the full, you know, the rubber kind of hit the road for me, and I fully understood what StoryCorps was about. And, none of us is, you know, we're, StoryCorps, I hope, reminds us to kind of, focus on what's really important and to tell the people who really matter to us now how much they mean to us. And doing these interviews, whether it's through StoryCorps, whether you do it yourself, or, you know, helping people listen to these stories or giving them the book, but especially doing the interviews, is something that you don't want to wait to do. It's really, you know, there are two things that I can guarantee from doing an interview like this. One is that no matter how well you know the person who you're interviewing, you're going to find out things you never knew. I was just, you know, 10 minutes ago, someone else told me that. I mean, I hear that every day. And also, it's something you're just never going to regret. You know, this is about human connection. It's about recognizing what's important. And there's no better feeling, you know, than having one of these conversations. You know, I get to do about one of them a year, and invariably, you know, it's a crazy day. All of us have crazy days. And I never want to do it. And then I get in the room, and time just stops.
All right, Dave, thank you so much for spending this time with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was StoryCorps founder Dave Isay. His new book is Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps.
Coming up, we'll take a look at new drunk driving legislation in the State Assembly today. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to the author of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid books about the latest installment in the series.
But first, we're talking about three new drunk driving bills that passed in the State Assembly today in Wisconsin. All three of these bills would toughen the penalties for those who drive drunk.
Frank Harris is with us, State Legislative Affairs Manager for Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Frank, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the call.
So it sounds like the Assembly moved pretty quickly today. Three pieces of legislation on drunk driving, and three of them passed.
Yeah, that is correct. And Matt is very thankful for that, especially one measure was just introduced last week, and it already passed the Assembly. So that's a good sign of the movement in Wisconsin to reform the drunk driving law. And again, all three of these measures are very important in reforming the state's OWI law. Well, and we're very happy, but there's still, you know, more room for improvement.
Let's take the bills one at a time.
Sure.
One of them would require a first-time drunk driver to not only pay a fine, which they already mm-hmm. do, I believe, but appear in court as well. Why is that a step, as you see it, in the right direction?
Well, again, drunk driving is a choice, and that bill demonstrates that drunk driving is a serious offense, and it's worthy of more attention than just a simple traffic infraction. And, you know, Matt believes that anybody who makes the choice to drive drunk has at the very least earned the opportunity to appear in court to face the consequences of their reckless decision.
How does Wisconsin stack up against other states when it comes to criminalizing first-time drunk driving?
Well, you know, most states have some sort of criminal penalty for a first offense, at least an option on the book where an offender could be charged with a first of a criminal misdemeanor. And actually in Wisconsin, they can charge first-time offenders who drive drunk with a child passenger in a vehicle with a criminal misdemeanor on the first offense. But all in all, Wisconsin is really one state that does not, at least on the book, criminalize all first offenses.
Another bill of the three would raise the penalty for repeat offenders, making the fourth offense, as I understand it, a felony. Why is that needed when we get to the fourth offense?
Well, again, by the time someone's a repeat offender, there's a lot going on and just a slap at a wrist. There needs to be treatment, there needs to be incarceration, there needs to be an all-of-the-above approach. And that bill really gives prosecutors more tools in handling these repeat drunk drivers who either have four convictions in their lifetime or at least two convictions. And this closes a loophole where some repeat drunk drivers are simply falling through the cracks.
All right. And then the third one involves ignition interlocks. Now, first of all, what are those and how does this change the laws on the books?
Well, first of all, ignition interlocks, since 2006, this has been our top legislative priority in every single state. And an ignition interlock is tied into a vehicle's ignition of a convicted drunk driver. And an offender who's ordered on one of these, at least in Wisconsin, has to blow into the device to prove their sobriety. And then some come with cameras to verify the identity of the user. And then there's also rolling retests where the offender has to, again, is prompted given time to, again, blow into the device. So you just can't have a friend at a bar blow into it. So they become sophisticated devices, and they're very effective compared to the traditional sanction of just hoping for the best with license suspension alone. In Wisconsin, ignition interlocks, as of 2010, are required for all the repeat all offenders who refuse, and first-time offenders of a 0.15 BAC or greater. And what Assembly Bill 467 does is it essentially closes a loophole where if a offender who was ordered on one of these interlocks by a judge was driving a non-interlocked vehicle and was pulled over by law enforcement, all law enforcement could do is just give him a driving on a suspended license violation, as opposed to a more serious offense such as driving without a court-ordered interlock. So that closes this loophole. And again, this is a very important bill because throughout the United States, Matt has been advocating tirelessly for more effective ignition interlock laws.
And that's been a criticism of laws so far. Won't they just drive somebody else's car? This tries to close that option.
Correct. And, well, this helps close that. And it's not a silver bullet, but it's more effective than, which is a current approach for first offenders at a 0.08 to a 0.14 blood alcohol level, which is just an occupational license where it's geographically restricted or time restricted. How in the world is that even enforced? And we hope that the next step that the Assembly takes is introducing legislation that gives an option for a first offender to go on an interlock restricted license and where they can drive wherever they want to, as opposed to the current approach, which is just a hope for the best occupational type license, which is, quite frankly, just we're not sure how that's being enforced.
We've got a caller on the line. Lauren in Ripon wants to talk about this. Lauren, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. My understanding with over policy is that it's not effective, and creating these laws and continuing to do so and making them stricter and greater punishments doesn't seem to be making a difference. If you look at some of the data from Utah, they have very hardcore laws that don't prove to be that effective. So,
all right. Thanks for the call, Lauren. So the people who are out drunk driving are maybe not thinking things through well enough to be deterred by these stricter punishments, Frank.
Well, you know, again, thanks, Lauren, for that phone call. And you know, that's why Matt has been pushing for more effective penalties. And you know, I'm from Wisconsin. I get told every time I come back there that, well, you know, you just enforce the laws that are on the books. Well, it's hard to enforce the laws on the books when there's conflicting loopholes throughout the statutes. And the bills that were authored by Representative Jim Ott that successfully passed the Assembly today closes those loopholes. And again, what's also key is enforcement of these laws. And that's why law enforcement should be given the option, you know, to continue with saturation patrols, and there should be an adult discussion on sobriety checkpoints. And enforcing these laws is critical as well.
And that's I wanted to talk about things that aren't in these laws today. Sobriety checkpoints is something you're looking for?
Well, that's going to be very difficult to advance in Wisconsin. But again, it's just educating on what exactly sobriety checkpoints are. And today we're really talking about, you know, these three bills, which are a very important improvement. But, you know, as it relates to other things that could help improve and make the law more effective in Wisconsin, it would be enforcing the current laws in the books. And one way to do that is effectively is through sobriety checkpoints. But it's going to be a difficult hill to climb. But what might be more possible is something that, such as the ignition interlock starting on the first offense at a 0.08, giving that option to a first offender to go on an interlock restricted license following an arrest as opposed to a occupational license. And if an offender's on an interlock license, they could drive wherever they want to, as opposed to the current law where they're restricted to where they can drive, which is just unenforceable and unworkable.
One argument I've seen from some people is part of the solution to drunk driving in Wisconsin is to change our culture where it isn't just accepted as something we take for granted. Do you think stricter legal penalties, in addition to the penalties themselves, help change that culture?
Well, need to change laws in order to change culture. And I doubt it's the culture of Wisconsin that in 2011, 196 people were killed in drunk driving crashes. Crashes caused by somebody who made the choice to drive drunk and risk their lives as well as their fellow citizens' lives. So, in order to change culture, you need to change laws. And one way to do this is with a more effective approach. And these three bills are a better way to change these laws and also just continue with the discussion that always plan ahead and designate a non-sober drinking driver when you're going out. Use the taxpayer-funded Safe Ride program if it's available in your county. There's no reason to drive drunk today in 2013.
And just briefly looking ahead, these passed the Assembly today. Are you optimistic they'll pass the Senate and cross the governor's desk?
Well, Matt's hopeful that it'll move forward, that these three bills as well as I think there's another bill, Assembly Bill 180, will move forward in the Senate. Because, again, these are needed improvements that stakeholders and Representative Jim Ott and Senator Darling have worked very tirelessly on.
All right, Frank, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That's Frank Harris, State Legislative Affairs Manager for Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Now it's time for a look at the dreaded days of middle school mishaps with Jeff Kinney, author of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series.
The series deals with dorky protagonist Greg Heffley, who can't seem to catch a break as he navigates the complexities of his early teens.
Jeff Kinney has been called a children's book rock star. He's sold tens of millions of copies of his books around the globe. To date, his books have been turned into three films as well. The eighth installment in his Wimpy Kid series is called Hard Luck, comes out today. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why have people gravitated so much to your lead character, Greg Heffley?
I think that kids see themselves in Greg. You know, when I read books as a kid and the central character was heroic, I felt like I was reading about miniature adults and not like kids like I was. So I wanted to create a character who was more like I was as a kid and less like the heroes in today's films and TV shows.
And that's what I make of Greg when I've read the books with my kids or watched the movies. Sometimes he's a bit of a jerk. Sometimes his troubles with friends are of his own making.
Right. I think that if any of our lives were documented while we were in middle school, we wouldn't come out looking too favorably. So I really wanted to kind of capture that kind of spirit for these books, is that Greg, he's not a bad guy. He's just a kid that is, he's not fully formed yet. He's not a fully formed person yet. So he's a work in progress.
And that seems like something anybody in middle school, junior high could identify with, definitely.
Right.
Well, I hate to ask authors how much of you is in this character, but you kind of alluded to it, so I'll ask you, how much of you is in Greg?
I think that all the worst parts of me are in Greg, actually. So I think that, he's the parts I'm not so proud of.
And do you, I know you do book signing events around the country. Do you meet the middle schoolers who are reading it? Do they say, there's a little bit of me there, I really identify with this guy?
Yeah. What's funny is actually I don't speak to a lot of middle schoolers. I think most middle schoolers have just slightly outgrown my books. Some kids in middle school still read them, but most of the kids I talk to are elementary school kids, and I think they really understand Greg. There's some sort of connection there that I think I understand.
That fits the pattern. That's my kids read and still read it in elementary school, so that makes sense. So one thing I didn't know, the first Diary of a Wimpy Kid started as a web series. How did you start releasing it that way?
That's right. I started releasing it on a website called FunBrain, which was a part of a company that I worked for, part of Pearson. And I was working for this website, and we needed to figure out how to get people to come back to the site during the summer because the traffic was very high during the school year. And so I said, well, I've been working on this thing for, the past 7 or 8 years, and I think that, we might be able to run it in daily installments and see if people will come back.
And the diary format works really well for that.
It does. It sort of just predated blogging, right when blogging was becoming popular on the web, daily bits of content. I was starting to release these daily installments, and I found that kids, that actually adults from all over the world were reading what I was writing, and it was very exciting to get emails from Pakistan and Russia and China of adults, professionals that were reading about Greg Heffley and waiting to hear what happened next.
I think I saw you quoted somewhere saying you thought maybe this is too American originally to have other people around the world interested in it. That you have found has proven not to be the case. Does it make the translation?
Yeah, my first concern was actually that it not ever feel dated. So I tried to generalize everything in terms of technology. I tried to take out any references to pop culture or to really any place and time kind of references. And I think that because of that, it's made the books sort of general and generic in a way. And I think that in a sense, childhood is the same everywhere. It's universal. So I think that's helped by making it to take out those references. It's really helped to make it appealing in other cultures and countries.
So that's why he writes in a diary, not on a blog or a tablet or something like that.
Right. If I would have made this the blog of a wimpy kid, I think, you know, 2 years from now, nobody would know what a
blog. What's a blog?
Right. Or Instagram of a wimpy kid. You know, you have to be careful about all that.
So in the newest installment, Hard Luck, Greg lost his best friend, Raleigh, and is trying to make new friends. What? Just give us a taste of what life is like without his closest childhood friend.
Right. Well, Raleigh has a girlfriend, and that's a shock to Greg's system. And what I was really trying to capture there was the feeling that you have as a teenager when your best friend gets a girlfriend or a boyfriend. And you lose them to that person. So I think there's a lot of humor to be found there. And then Greg, of course, has invested so heavily in this one guy that he finds out that he has to start over on the social ladder in middle school, which is not easy to do.
A lot of kids' books end with, maybe not explicitly, but a moral or a life lesson in it. Are you trying to do that, or do you want to leave that for other children's authors?
I really like to leave that to other children's authors because in my books, kids can sniff out a moral. Mm. It's why they jump so quickly from a show like Barney to something more sophisticated, and they can feel the heavy hand of an adult. So I certainly don't want my books to seem amoral. But I want them to feel like they're written for humor's sake and for entertainment's sake.
But given that people can identify with the main character in it, even if there's not a specific life lesson, I would imagine they can work through their own things and just by identifying with someone else.
Yeah, I read somebody online in a blog actually was writing about this very thing, and they were comparing Diary of a Wimpy Kid to Huckleberry Finn or Tom Sawyer, which is probably a bit too aspirational for my work. But what I really liked is that they said that that the writer, he let the readers make their own decisions. He trusted the readers to decide for themselves what they thought of the characters. And so I thought that was, Mark Twain doing that was really smart, and that's what I'm trying to do too, is that I would like for you to make up your own mind about Greg and the choices that he makes.
Now, Greg and some of the other characters in the book would be very happy playing video games all day, and that was part of my childhood and adulthood too, I'll admit, and my kids are kind of the same, and my kids have played on the Pop Tropica website, a game website, and you're the creator of that. This is another thing I just learned today. How'd you come to that day job?
I was working for Pearson, and we were running a website called Fun Brain, and it had its advantages and disadvantages. And one day I was mowing the lawn, and it came up with this idea for a virtual world for kids. And I wanted to just kind of do it on my own, but I realized that we had this big audience and a great company behind us, so I'd be more successful in doing it in-house. So I still actually have my job there, and it's been very rewarding to have that to counterbalance the Wimpy Kid stuff.
Well, I wonder, are there lessons that apply to both of your worlds there? Are there ways that you engage a kid reader and a kid gamer that inform each other back and forth?
I think that what you need to do is you need to treat the kid as a sophisticated consumer. I was worried about that when I first released my books, because the tone was a little bit challenging. Greg is unreliable, and he's very flawed, which is a little bit unusual for kids series. So I think that with both properties, we try to write at a certain level of sophistication, and then hope our readers meet us there.
So I always wonder about this with kids' books and with shows like The Simpsons. Do you plan to age Greg and the other characters over the years? Are we going to see the high school years of a Wimpy Kid?
I used to actually worry about that a lot because I said, boy, Greg is going through a lot of middle school moments here, and eventually he's going to grow up. And then I had sort of a breakthrough thought was that Greg's DNA is really in cartoons. It's not in literature. And so I decided that Greg would stay the same age forever. And fact, I have a book called The Ugly Truth, which is the fifth book, and it's about puberty. And in that book, Greg's classmates are you know, they're going through the signs of puberty, like facial hair and pimples and all that. And Greg is frustrated that he's not growing up. And, you know, it's sort of my joke with myself is that he's not growing up because he can't, because he's a cartoon character.
So just in our last 30 seconds or so, in your head, does Greg grow up and when, kind of like you have? He's a successful children's author or with a computer company. Does he run Google someday?
I think Greg would grow up and not be a happy person. He'd be a victim of his own, you know, thought processes. So I think that he'll be a, you know, a middle manager somewhere who's pretty petty. Whereas his friend Rowley, who's a bit of a doofus right now, will grow up to be a healthy and well-rounded person.
All right. Well, good luck to Greg Rowley and to you, Jeff.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That's Jeff Kinney, author of the Diary of Wimpy Kid series. Newest installment out today. It's called Hard Luck.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, one guest says that we need a national town hall on football and the health risks associated with it.
And we'll discuss ways to improve science education around the country.
And then the Roller Derby World Championships are coming to Milwaukee, and we'll take a look at the sport that's seen a surge in popularity in the past decade.
That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll hear about a rise in online niche dating. We're thinking farmers only or gluten-free singles. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.